This is the Careering into Motherhood podcast, and I'm Jane Johnson. My guest today is Charlotte Worth. Charlotte began her career at the BBC as a producer on Radio 2. When the opportunity for redundancy came up, she put her hand up but was declined, and it caused her to reassess her career and whether she really wanted to stay at the BBC. The rest we'll talk about today and get Charlotte's views on the top five pieces of advice she's learned over the years. Charlotte Worth, I am delighted to be talking to you this morning. And it's a bit of a change for you to be on that side of the microphone because you began your career at the BBC Sound, didn't you?
Yeah, in production. I worked for majority of my career for Radio 2. So I was definitely on the other side of the microphone, producing and instructing the presenters on what to say. And whenever they invited me into the studio to talk on the microphone, I would freeze up and would not be able to say anything at all. And then we're like, right, you can go because you were useless.
You're more on the technical side.
Well, not so much the technical side, but more the telling them what to do. That's the creative side. I didn't want my voice to be heard on the radio.
I see. It sounds like quite a big step to move from radio media into, you know, what's potentially quite a solitary career as a coach. You know, you've gone from being part of a big team, really buzzy, very much at the front of everything that's happening in the world. And then now you're sort of one-to-one with people, and I guess mostly or often working from home. What was it that prompted that decision?
Well, it didn't happen automatically. I'd spent about 18 years at the BBC and had loved it. It gave me so many opportunities that I never imagined possible. I met lots of my heroes, had lots of my illusions shattered as well along the way. I really loved it. And then when I went back to work after my second child, I went back to Radio 2, and I'd always loved my time there, really had. But suddenly the glitter had disappeared, and I just thought, if I'm going to come to work every day, I want to do something that I really, really enjoy. So I changed department and moved into the live events for the BBC. So all the events that Radio 1, Radio 2, 6 Music did, all the big music events. And on paper, it was really exciting. We got to do some amazing things, but in practice, it was really hard. I had two young children. Nobody else in the department had children at that time. My husband is a sound engineer for the BBC, so he works really random hours. And I just felt this pull from all directions. I felt that I wanted to be with the team because part of being with the team was going out after work and going to the pub and all those things. But I needed to go home because I had two children. And I just felt this constant pull each way and thought, I am going to snap. So they offered redundancy. I put my hand up and they said no. But in that process, because it takes forever, I realised that actually, yes, this is what I wanted to do. So I jumped ship, which is a shame because the redundancy package was lovely at the BBC, so I probably should have stayed.
Oh, so you left, you took that leap saying, I can't wait for this process, for the consultation.
Yeah, well, no, I did wait for the process, but when the process came back, they said, no, we don't want you to leave. But I thought, well, actually, during this process, I've really thought about it, and actually the redundancy money isn't important to me. I need to go, I need a change. I went into freelance world, and that was a huge shock. I had no plan. I just jumped. I had a year's contract and that was great. And then at the end of that year's contract, I was like, oh, what do I do now? And my husband was like, well, you're not networking for the last year. I was like, what's networking? Because I'd never had to network at the BBC. Everything was at my fingertips because everybody came to us rather than the other way around. It was a real shock. And I'd been institutionalised. I'd never worked anywhere else, so I didn't really know how everything worked. So I succeeded as a freelancer, but I didn't really enjoy it. And then I started working for London Business School as a freelancer there and started working alongside coaches. And I think from the first time since I started working at as a temp at the BBC, I was just like, oh, I want to do that job. That's what I want your job. And I'd originally done my degree in psychology and I'd always intended to become a therapist, but had got a summer job at the BBC, was dazzled by the bright lights and stayed. So after I went out for dinner with somebody who I didn't realise was a coach who worked for the school. And by the end of the evening, I was going home, looking up coaching courses and haven't looked back.
The rest is history.
Yes, it is. But it is lonely, like you said.
You have a big brand behind you. I worked for big brands and most recently at HSBC, most recently, about 10 years ago now. But it's so easy when you pick up the phone and say, oh, hi, I'm phoning from HSBC. Immediately people know who you are. And then when you're phoning up and you're saying, hi, I'm Jane Johnson or Charlotte Worth, it's harder. It's really hard. And that idea of having to network, having to rebuild your network when you've also got two young children at home and you've got everything else, all the pulls there, there isn't a lot of time for kind of extracurricular stuff. So yeah, really empathize. And I think that also taking that leap, you know, some people spend a year while still in employment, as you say, your husband said, well, you know, didn't you think about building the business? I did exactly the same. I was like, I need to just go. I need to go and do my own thing. But you've clearly managed to do it and very successfully. So today I would like to talk about your five pieces of guidance. I'm always at great pains to say this is not advice to anybody. It's really just guidance, things you have learned that either you hold in your mind and the way you sort of live your life and run your career, or things that you help clients with. So with all of that said, can we kick off with number one?
Even if your head is saying no, say yes. Because if you say no to everything, then you're going to miss out on the opportunities. Where if you say yes, then you think, well, I've got to work it out. I think there was a LinkedIn survey a few years ago that women, when they apply for that next job up, unless they know 99.999% of the job, they won't go for it. Whereas on the whole, men will go, oh, I could do 60% of it.
Exactly.
I'll work it out. And I think that but the reason you're leaving your job is because you're bored. You're not stretching yourself. And the only way to stretch yourself is to do something new. So say yes and then work it out. And then look at it like a jigsaw. Like if you got a 1,000-piece jigsaw, poured it all out on the table, that those pile of pieces looks really daunting. So for me, I work out the framework first, and then I find the most obvious parts of the picture and I work on those. And that's the same as when you take that job that you don't know how to do. Look at the things you can do, and then hopefully the things that you can't do will start to sort of blend in the same way that it does in the jigsaw. Those bits that you thought, oh, that's really difficult, actually you'll find that it links on to that big bit that you've just put in. So just say yes and then work it out afterwards.
We have to admit here, that is partly a kind of entrepreneurial mindset. And I will never forget when I first set up on my own, I went and spoke to somebody who'd done something similar and was very, very successful. And his piece of advice was exactly that, but with regards to business, never say no to business, say yes, and then go away and think about how you're going to make it happen. He said the first time he went in, pitched to a huge firm, he was a one-man band, and he sat there going, yes, yes, we can definitely do this for you. Yes, he said he walked outside and literally hit his head on the wall saying, you know, what were you thinking? How on earth are we going to do this? But he did it and went on to be very successful. And I think maybe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your point is more around that rather than say yes when your gut is really telling you, no, this is wrong.
Yeah, yeah, I do believe in following your gut. But I think sometimes when we're scared, it's just easy to say no, okay, yes. I won't do it. But like your friend, I do say yes and then I put the phone down or shut my laptop and think, no! How am I going to do it? And then once the panic subsides and I start breathing again, then the thoughts come in, oh, I can do this. And then once that first creative thought comes in, then you build on it in the same way that you build on your jigsaw. When you put that first framework in, then you can start to see how it will happen.
You know, that must be where the learning comes in and doing your own thing, or you have no idea how you're going to do it, and then you figure out a way, whether that's using network, leaning on resources and people that you know. Great, brilliant advice. I love it. What's your next one, please?
Well, the next one we call in our house channeling your inner Freddie Flintoff.
Okay. I know who he is, at least.
He's a cricketer, but he's also on Top Gear. And my youngest son, Harry, loves Top Gear and loves Freddie, because Freddie will do anything and say, I don't get nervous, I get excited. And there's one particular program where he's strapped into a car and the car is going to bungee jump off the side of this. It's strapped into the side of a bridge facing downwards, and he's strapped into the car, and then there's obviously this huge elastic band. And the other two, Paddy and Chris, are going, oh, you're not scared? It's like, no, this is really, really exciting. What's the worst that can happen? You could die. But he doesn't obviously see. And he turns that nerves into excitement, which is what sports people do. They never go on to, in his case, the cricket pitch or the football pitch or the running track, thinking, oh God, I'm really nervous, I'm not going to be able to do this. They go on there thinking, I'm going to succeed at this. I'm going to score that winning goal. I am going to run the fastest time. The reason that they do that is because they're prepared beforehand. So they're excited. They don't need to be nervous because they know that they've done everything beforehand to make sure that they are strong enough, capable enough, and confident enough to do it. And my son uses his inner Freddie Flintoff, which is why we call it that, because 8 months ago, he wouldn't even go on the local slide at the swimming pool, one of those spinny slides. It was absolutely petrified. And then 2 weeks ago, he went on the London Orbital slide, which is the fastest, longest slide in Europe, I believe. And before he went, I was like, just channel Freddie. And he did. The thing about it is he was prepared. He knew what to expect. He'd watched the videos. He knew what happened when he was in the slide. He wasn't going to fly out and shoot across London or anything like that. So he was prepared. And that's the same thing with confidence, is if you're prepared before you step into that office or into that meeting, you've done all your research, you've read all the notes, then that should hopefully make you feel more confident and make you excited about what's about to happen next, rather than, oh my gosh, I'm going to fail. Well, you won't fail because you've got all the information at your fingertips, and therefore just go and enjoy the experience.
It's a really good point. I used to have to give quite a lot of presentations to senior management, and I used to dread them really. But now I do quite a lot of pitching proposals and things of selling careering into motherhood, really. And I don't dread them at all. I love them, because what I realise, exactly to your point, is that previously, A, I wasn't massively interested or invested in it. So I didn't spend the time preparing. So I was massively exposed. Whereas now, this is my thing. I know everything. I'm happy to take any challenge leveraged at me because I know it intimately. And obviously I believe in it and so on. So it is that difference between why I feel confident. It's not that I've suddenly found some inner confidence. It's to do with the preparation.
Yeah, it is. And as you said, and I think this does help as well, that it's your baby, it's your passion. And as a coach, I push myself far more than I ever did at the BBC. I was successful at the BBC, but I got there by chance, and I always felt the whole time I just got lucky. As a coach now, I know that there's no such thing as just get lucky. I got lucky in that initial stage because I was temping. I happened to get on with the person who had hired me, and she kept creating roles until I got a role within the job. But then I had to work really hard to stay there. So there is no such thing as lucky. But here, as a coach, I really want to do this. I want this to succeed. So I pushed myself. Like I said at the beginning, you would have never found me on this side of the microphone when I was at the BBC. I found that petrifying. But now I know that it will help me to do what I really want to do.
Yes, it's a great piece of advice. It really is. So we'll move on to your third piece, please.
Well, my next bit sort of leads on from the confidence bit and about feeling positive about yourself. But I think the other thing that helps you with confidence is to listen, and to overcome anxiety and stress is to listen to your body. And recently I've become really interested in embodiment coaching, which is about listening to the signals that your body tells you. Because I often think that your body knows when you're stressed before your brain catches up with you. And I was watching it when all the TV was showing lots of different films about the Queen and her life. I was watching this video on Princess Diana, and she was sitting at this dinner, and her body language was so close. Her shoulders were hunched, her arms were literally wrapped around like that, and she was sort of hiding her face. And I find that if my shoulders are scrunched in and I'm sort of hunched in, I'm really nervous. And I've learned that if I'm feeling anxious or stressed, my shoulders become really tight. I feel like I have a tight pressure on my chest, and I feel like somebody's got my tummy and they're like wringing it tightly. And I now know that if I'm starting to feel those feelings, well, okay, I'm stressed, or I'm anxious. And in order to get myself out of that, I sit or stand straight, put my shoulders down and back, and then I start to breathe. And then as soon as you start to breathe, that slows everything down. Because when you're all hunched up, your heart can't pump properly because it sort of turns into a bit of a helix shape. It's not sending the messages to the fear part of your brain, which is the amygdala, because it sends a regular pulse up to that part of the brain. And when that pulse changes, your brain goes, oh, okay, there's something going wrong here. When your heartbeat starts changing, your breathing stops, slows down, or it speeds up because the blood's not pumping around properly. But if you're able to then open up your chest, lower your shoulders and breathe, it slows everything down. The messages stop going to your brain, because when you start sending panic messages to that fear part, the cortisol hormone starts flowing through your body, and that's the fear hormone. And then it all sort of gets out of control and you become very funnel visioned and you just look at the negative. Because if you start to breathe again, you start slowing everything down, then your thoughts become more normal. So, and you probably won't, when you're in the moment, notice it, but afterwards reflect back about how was my body feeling? Where did I feel the stress? What could I do to change it? And also think about, what are you telling yourself? Are you telling yourself, oh my gosh, I can't do this. This is really difficult. If you're telling yourself those messages, then that's going to speed up your heart rate, because you're going to start panicking, you're going to start breathing more quickly, and then it sort of goes into a circle again. So it's about, first of all, listen to your body, slow everything down, and then listen to the thoughts in your head and reframe them and turn them on their head and make them more positive. And then the cycle will start to go back to a normal pace.
Really interesting. And you talked earlier about listening to your gut, and that phrase alone, I am no medic or scientist, but I gather that the gut has its own nervous system, doesn't it? So that sense of, oh my God, I'm really nervous, my stomach's all tight, I can't do this, then that naturally then affects your breathing, and it all leads on from there.
I mean, I found myself in situations where recently I went back in June, I went back to coaching face to face, and I haven't done that since pre-pandemic. And I suddenly became really nervous. I was thinking, why am I nervous? I do this about 6-7 times a day on Zoom. What's the issue? The person I was coaching, English was their second language, so I was finding it hard to understand them. That had a really strong accent and they were talking really quietly. I just started to panic, thinking, I can't help this person, I can't help this person. And I thought, I need to sit back, I need to put my shoulders down and I need to breathe. But then I realised that I'd actually crammed myself really tightly between the table and the wall. And I'd wrapped my legs around each other as well. And in order to sort of unravel myself, the whole table and everything was going to move. And I was thinking, I can't do that because that's going to distract them. And then I just thought, I don't have to do it. Because if I don't do it, then I'm not going to be able to do this coaching session. And I really am not going to be able to help them. So once I did that, and then I sat back and I breathed and I just calmed myself down, it was fine after that. So it really does make a difference.
So if you're feeling nervous, you can almost trick the brain into feeling more relaxed by doing things around your positioning, your stance, your body. Your fourth piece.
My fourth piece is, don't always be the fixer at work. I think...
Oh, okay. I really like this. I really like this, especially for women, I think.
Absolutely. I think that nurturing side of us comes into play. I think when you first start working, it's really good to be the person that says, yes, I can do that. Yes, I'll do that. And I remember giving talks to students who wanted to get into the music industry or the media industry and saying, yep, when you first start, make as many cups of teas as you can. Be the person that's always there helping them, making the tea, because you'll get to know people, they'll see that you're willing, and they'll want to give you more. But there comes a point where you have to stop doing that, because if you are the person that is always fixing everything within your organisation, they're not going to want you to move. You'll get to a point where they don't want you to move up any further, because if you move up, who's going to do it all? And I recently coached somebody who'd moved from the States to the UK to do an MBA course over here. When she announced to her company that she was leaving, they actually said, no, please don't, because you do everything and we can't, we'll pay you more to stay. And she's like, this is why I need to actually leave the country and do an MBA so that I can learn the skills to not be the person that's always helping. And at the beginning, it does help you, because you do get to know lots of other people. You get to know lots of different skills, because if you're always willing to say, yep, I'll try that, I'll try that, that's great. But then if you become too good, then it sort of stops you from going any further. And I find that a lot with women.
Yeah, it's rarely that they'll give you the big strategic project. It's, could you organise the leaving lunch and the leaving presents and all of that kind of stuff? It's so true. You know, you think you're doing it just to help make yourself indispensable, but there's a fine line between indispensable and then just stuck in a corner.
Absolutely.
Which
leads on to my final one, which is learn to say no. And in order to learn to say no, you need to think about what motivates you to say yes all the time. What's the motivation behind it? Why are you saying yes? Is it because you don't want to upset people? Is it because if you don't say yes to that, they'll think, oh, she's not very helpful, therefore we don't want to give her that promotion? So work out the reasons why you're saying yes all the time. Then think of alternatives, what you can do to not offend them or upset them if that's what you're worried about, but that you can still say no. So say, yes, I'm more than happy to do that, but if I do that, would you be able to take this off my hand? Or I can't do it at the moment, but maybe I can see that in 2 weeks' time, I've got a space in my diary, I can do it then. So you're not letting somebody down completely, you're offering them an alternative, or that you're showing them that, yes, I would really love to do this, but there are only so many hours in the day and I've already got all this that I need to do. So what isn't important to you that I can take away in order to do this?
I mean, it's interesting to me, that side of things, because I often say yes to too much, frankly. And I have a sort of fear that, I mean, and I'm talking whether that's domestically, whether that's around the sort of school and things to do there or at work. And it's really interesting, your question around why do I feel I have to say yes all the time? And I actually think, getting very personal here, it's something around wanting to be liked. And I feel if I say no, that potentially offends someone, or then they'll think, she's a bit stroppy or or whatever. But I suppose, so leading on from your point about think about why you say yes or why you can't say no, then once you've got that answer, how do you go about saying, well, actually, is that so bad? Is that so bad if people think, she was a bit rude there? I mean, because if it's really innately in me not to want to do that stuff, why is it wrong that people should actually know how I feel?
And if you do feel uncomfortable about worrying about how people feel, because that is also changing a big part of your personality, work out a compromise. You offer them an alternative. You show them, actually, I would really love to do this, but it's really not possible at the moment. So that they understand that you're not saying no just because you're being mean or you can't be bothered. You're saying no for a reason. And if you do say yes to everything, then at some point you may be letting somebody down because you've actually got too much on your plate. And then at some point you are going to have to say no, but you've just delayed that. And actually, is that worse than saying no at the beginning?
Yeah, I'm just laughing slightly. It's not very funny. I was sharing on the podcast last year. I had this thing where I kind of said yes to everything. I think it was the sort of post-pandemic, as we were coming out and everyone was meeting face-to-face again. And my son joined the Beavers And I thought, oh, this is really sweet. And they were really stretched for resource and so on. So I said, I'll sign up and help to be a Beavers leader. And I mean, fun of me, it's not me. In fact, all my friends, when I told them, they just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. But it was so not me. I got to the point every Tuesday or whenever the evening was, I was starting to dread it. I was starting to dread it because it was just not me. I felt really uncomfortable in that role. And it honestly, Charlotte, it took me 8 months to gather the courage to tell them, I'm sorry, I need to pull out. And I have let them down. I totally have let them down because I took on something I felt I ought to do and I simply didn't have the time. So it's a really pedestrian example, but it caused me a lot of heartache.
But exactly. And what makes you think that you deserve, you have to go through that heartache?
Yeah, there are plenty of other parents who can sign up.
Exactly. What's stopping them from signing up? And also, if you're dreading it that much, you're not giving your whole self when you're there. And actually, they're probably not getting as much out of you as they would like to anyway. So actually, by saying no initially, you help yourself and probably them as well, because somebody else might have stepped in and actually thought, oh, actually, I really enjoy doing this.
Yeah, hopefully. Let's look at it through that lens. Really good pieces of advice, though, and really interesting, multifaceted. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
And
I hope it wasn't too bad being that side of the microphone.
It wasn't at all. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
My thanks to Charlotte there for really personal insight. And obviously I shared some personal challenges of my own, but it just goes to show how universally applicable her five pieces of guidance were. She's a brilliant coach and I really enjoyed talking to her. Thank you all for listening and we'll see you next time.